This is To Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is a provocateur, professor, and purveyor of political passions, Dr. James McLeod. He's a Scot who ended up in the Midwest and is now sharing his wit in political and editorial cartoons, appearing in the Evansville Courier. Dr. McLeod is also a history professor at the University of Evansville and author of books highlighting Evansville during World War II and showcasing the art and commentary of longtime Courier cartoonist Carl K. Kinect. Dr. McLeod, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
Well, you're a long way from your birth home in Scotland, but you have landed in a place with its own unique food offering. Now, from haggis to brain sandwiches, right?
I think I would prefer haggis, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've looked at the menu for haggis. It's not too appealing. Of course, brain sandwiches not too appealing either to a lot of people. So haggis, what is haggis?
Well, haggis, I think, is similar to what most food cultures have among poor people, which was simply the desire to eat everything. And so nothing went to waste. So haggis is really just a variation on sausage that you see across most cultures, a mixture of kind of cheap cuts of meat and packaging, in this case oatmeal, and some herbs and spices. What turns some people off is that it was traditionally cooked inside the stomach of a sheep. But nowadays they're typically cooked in a kind of plastic sheath, so that covers that.
Well, I think it's like the suet and oatmeal, and they call it the sheep's pluck.
Mm-hmm.
A pluck, is that the innards?
Yeah, it's just awful, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the pieces of meat that we typically throw away today. But I think if you look at most food cultures, I think there's that element there where we chop up the stuff that used to get thrown away and mix it in and make use of it.
Now, would you have haggis for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or anytime?
Typically, people would eat it for dinner, and it's not something that people eat on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, there's a kind of ceremonial element that's typically associated with the national poet of Scotland, Robert Burns. Mm-hmm. And on his birthday, the 25th of January, people typically celebrate that, and the meal that's eaten is haggis.
Well, there you go. Okay, I learned a lot there. So how did you end up going from Scotland to Evansville, James?
Well, my first step was going from Scotland to England, to Harlaxton, the University of Evansville's campus there just north of London. I had finished my PhD at the University of Edinburgh and was looking for a job, and this job was advertised, and I went down to Harlaxton and, like everybody else, was completely blown away when I saw it. Mm-hmm. And got a job there and was there for 5 years and then moved over to Evansville and actually 20 years ago.
Now, Harlaxton, I've been there a couple of times.
Right.
My daughter studied there.
Okay.
And she was very impressed because really you get a chance to, it's kind of like your point to go travel to the rest of Europe, and they get a lot of time to travel too there.
Oh yeah, it was really amazing experience to watch kids grow up really there. You know, the experience of traveling on your own is wonderful, but I have to say, on a personal note, as a teacher, it was a very frustrating place to work because, you know, you spent your weekends grading their papers and then they were going off to Barcelona or Greece
and then coming back with their stories.
Absolutely. So you tried to keep your jealousy out of your grading.
Now, you became an American citizen.
Yes, I did, in 2012. So after I'd been here for over 10 years, I got tired of taxation without representation. So I understand that's been an issue before. I just thought that, you know, if you're going to be fully invested in a country, you should go in the whole way. And it was a very, very moving experience for me. Becoming a U.S. citizen, and that first time walking into it was actually a library here in Evansville to vote, was a pretty moving experience too. So, you know, I think if you're living in a country and gaining its benefits, you need to take the responsibilities that go with that. So I'm very proud American.
Are you also a dual citizen with the United Kingdom?
It's a little bit complicated, but yes. And you know, our children would be too, which I had always thought would be this wonderful advantage for our children. children because they would then be citizens of the EU. Mm-hmm. And then the British people disappointed me by voting for Brexit,
right.
Which kind of ruins things for my children. It was very inconsiderate of the British people.
Now, you're married to an American?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. My wife, Jess, she's a nurse practitioner here in town. So I always used to joke that my dad was a minister and was very well known, and I'm the youngest of seven kids. So everywhere I went, I was always either my father's son or somebody's little brother. And I thought when I came to Evansville, I would finally be my own. I'd be my own man. But now, pretty much everywhere I go, people say, "Oh, you're Jess's husband." So it's she's a really great person, obviously, and a great nurse practitioner. And she's from Boston originally, but we're pretty firmly settled here in Evansville now.
Well great. Now, do you still have family back in Scotland?
Yeah, I've got. My family's fairly scattered. Both my parents have passed away. I've got some family in Scotland, some in England, some in New Zealand, and some in Australia. So we're pretty scattered across the world.
Now, of course, obviously you love history, now, especially European history, the studies of World Wars I and II. Were your parents very political?
Well, I'd answer that question in two parts. I mean, I think, my interest in the world wars is definitely a product of family, I think. My mom's father, my grandfather, he was a stretcher bearer in the trenches of World War I. And his brothers fought on various fronts in the First World War. The First World War is kind of ever present in Britain and much of Europe in a way that it isn't here. So World War I was always a big part of my consciousness. And then in World War II, my dad was actually in the British Merchant Navy and sailed on the North Atlantic convoys during the war. Contracted TB during the war, and so in some ways as a victim of the war as well. So I think I kind of grew up just absorbing that interest in the two world wars. As far as politics is considered, my parents were vaguely political, but I wouldn't say they were activists. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing that dominated their life was religion, a very conservative religion that tended, I think, to push them towards a rather conservative political worldview as well.
Were Episcopalian or Church of England?
Presbyterian.
Oh, Presbyterian.
So Scottish Presbyterian. So part of really one of the most fundamentalist Protestant churches anywhere in the world. We didn't do anything on Sundays except religious activities. You couldn't shower, you couldn't shine your shoes, you couldn't shave. I mean, it was almost like a Jewish Sabbath.
Hmm.
And in fact, it was called Sabbath. We had 2 1.5-hour services every Sunday.
And you had to be there.
Oh, you bet. You know, we were in the minister's pew. You know, so it was a huge part of. What formed my identity, I think, was just being in this, and it was a relatively it was a church that was almost its own community, as many churches are, and they saw themselves as really the only people that had the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this sense that you were growing up in a world that was sinful and going in the wrong direction, and we were the only ones who were right. Which is a kind of curious environment to grow up as a child. I mean, just real fast, I'd also say one thing that always my students always find really interesting is that this church was so conservative and so Bible-centered, we didn't celebrate Christmas because the Bible doesn't specifically tell you to celebrate Christmas. So, you know, it was considered a pagan festival, which it was, of course. And so on Christmas, we didn't get presents. We didn't have a tree. We had no lights, no cards. And now we did get presents a week later at New Year's. But I have to say that was by far the longest week of the year.
Oh,
was
gosh.
All your friends had already opened their presents and you were waiting for New Year to come. So, you know, I think I can't help feeling like that environment of just being different from everybody else helps to certainly shapes you as a child.
I'm sure your children enjoy Christmas the American way.
Oh, yeah.
Presents.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I think I've got great joy at Christmas, you know, because it was something I didn't have.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, okay, the cartoon part of your life, I understand you started doodling in class. Is that how you got into that?
Yeah, pretty much. I was always drawing little pictures and caricatures, I suppose, when I was a kid. And, you know, my mom was always telling me to quit, you know, because it was a waste of paper and a waste of time. When I was in college, I drew some cartoons for the school newspaper and that kind of thing. And then started realizing I could make some money. You know, I'd sold cartoons when I was in college and then graduate school. And it's just always, if this is a relatively rare occasion where I'm not sitting with a pen in my hand. If I was sitting here with a pen, I would be drawing. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm listening to people, I'm often drawing. When I'm watching TV, listening to radio, I'm drawing. So it's just almost a it's almost a subconscious activity in some ways.
Are your children artists? Do they have a passion for drawing?
I would say one of them is likes to draw, and they sometimes recognize themselves in my cartoons, which is always funny. But I think my oldest daughter is very interested in politics. The others less so. You know, they're younger, so we'll kind of wait and see, I guess.
Sure. Well, my guest is Dr. James McLeod, cartoonist, professor, and historian. So how did you land that job of being a cartoonist on the opinion page of The Courier? How did that happen?
It was like, I think, most other creative people. You just finally badger someone enough. You know, I'd sent lots of cartoons to the then opinion page editor, Chuck Leach. And at some point, some combo of him and Ryan Reynolds and others, saw a couple of cartoons that they liked and they used them. And then over the years, I was able to get more exposure on there. I had almost stopped drawing. Certainly, I'd stopped drawing formal cartoons. And I would say it was maybe the early 2000s, the Iraq War, especially, I think, kind of repoliticized me. And I thought, what can I do about this? And I started drawing cartoons. And I committed to, I think it was about 2005 maybe, I decided, as when blogs were kind of getting big, I thought if I started a blog, it would force me to draw every day, and so I did. So in about 2005, I started drawing something every day, and putting it online, and I've pretty much continued that ever since.
Now, is there a difference between an editorial and a political cartoon, or are they synonymous?
I think it's synonymous, yeah.
Now, this is the whole idea of cartooning. I think it goes back to, like, the cave drawings, people commenting on what they see and their life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've got no doubt that part of the reason that we respond to cartoons so strongly is that we were drawing pictures before we had a written language. And, I can imagine some kind of smart aleck caveman, drawing a caricature of Zog in the cave next door, and maybe Zog doesn't like it and coming and whacking him on the head. But yeah, I think we've always, if you look at in Pompeii, for example, there's some of the graffiti in Pompeii is caricatures of politicians with big noses and that kind of thing. So we've certainly been doing it for a long time.
Now, of course, the British social commentaries was a big deal. Like Hogarth, I think, he would draw pictures of the society in England and make fun of these pompous people where you had the poverty in the streets.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Hogarth and Rawlinson and a whole bunch of other guys over the 18th and 19th century who drew pictures that sometimes are still very funny, have a very pointed political agenda as well. And some of them, and again, I use cartoons a lot with students, and some of these 18th century images are still profoundly shocking, even today, to kids who are playing violent video games and so on. They look at one of these images and it jolts them.
I looked up, and Benjamin Franklin drew a cartoon. Says join or die, with the snake in different pieces, and the pieces of the snake are the colonies, and this was like wanting them to unite against the French and the Indians in that war. And of course, then I think it was adopted again as a Revolutionary War.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one too, right? Because it's been adopted since 2008 by the Tea Party. It's kind of the Tea Party flag in some ways, which I think shows the abiding power of these cartoons. That guy Benjamin Franklin was pretty talented.
Well, I know it. I mean, this guy is incredible. Yeah. You keep finding out new things about Benjamin Franklin. And of course, the American Thomas Nast, he was a great political cartoonist, and he really went after the politicians of his time.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things I think that is really powerful is the realization that some of the issues that you're wrestling with today, that we're all wrestling with today, were there 50 years ago and 100 years ago and 150 years ago. And Nast was a really persistent thorn in the flesh for you know, powerful political machines that were corrupt and
the Tammany Tiger.
Exactly, yeah. And had a really powerful influence on politics as well. I mean, these cartoons changed the way people saw these politicians and in the end brought down a lot of that Tammany Hall corruption. So, politicians, I think, like cartoonists sometimes, and they kind of like to be portrayed in cartoons, but at other times politicians have been, you know, very, very angry about the way they've been portrayed.
I think Nast also came up with the donkey for the Democrats and the elephant for the Republicans.
Yeah, that's what people say. It's a little bit hard to trace that exactly, but he's certainly one of the people who gets credited for that. And also, you know, drawing Santa Claus the way we see him today,
right.
I think that was Nast as well.
Yeah. And then you had Bill Maudlin, the cartoonist during World War II, depicting the average GI.
Yeah, one of the first books that I ever encountered that was dealing with World War II from an American perspective, so it was way back in probably the early 70s in Scotland, was a collection of his cartoons. And, you know, these kind of stubbly, scruffy GIs making their way through through wartime Europe. And even as a kid looking at that, you thought, wow. And well, today I've got several of his books at home and his collections of cartoons. And what an amazing talent.
Well, he would show the difference between the guys in on the front lines and the officers back in
exactly.
the tents eating their nice meal.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's funny too, because there's a lot of cartoons from World War II that reflect the cartoons that you see in World War I, which is the same thing, that the grunts, the poor bloody infantry, as they call themselves, are in the trenches, and the officers are sitting in some French chateau drinking wine.
Well, are there any taboos for a cartoonist, or is it pretty well, do you have a free rein at the Courier?
Well,
are you been censored? Have you been censored?
I mean, they either buy it or they don't.
Oh, that's
the
bottom line.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can read into that whatever you want.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean, they have been really good over the years for publishing me no matter what. Sometimes I push it a little bit and I submit a cartoon that I think they're probably not going to take this, and sometimes they don't, but every now and again I'm surprised that they do take it. And you know, some of my comments recently about immigration, about the Muslim ban and stuff like that, cartoons about gun control, which they know are going to be probably pretty unpopular with a lot of people, they've nevertheless gone ahead and published them. So I feel pretty good about what the Courier has done. As far as taboos, you know, I think you have to be your own, you have to have a conscience. You know, are there certain things that I wouldn't try to make money from? Are there certain things that I wouldn't draw about? Yes, but that's different for every cartoonist probably.
Well, now coming up, a James McLeod cartoon seen around the world. We're going to talk about that. Also, the importance of knowing our past, how being history challenged can actually be harmful to our future, and the incredible career of Carl K. Connect, whose cartoons were really front page news in the Evansville Courier for decades. This is To Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back to To Main Street. My guest is Dr. James McLeod, history professor at the University of Evansville, author and political cartoonist for the Evansville Courier. And James, one of your cartoons went viral. The pen is mightier than the sword. That's the drawing after the terrorist attack on the office of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris. I guess in January of 2015. Now, you saw this as an attack on free speech. Now, take us through the creation of that cartoon and the impact it had.
I had been aware of Charlie Hebdo and their portrayal of Islam before, and I knew that they had been attacked before. And so I sat down in my office that morning and clicked on, I think it was the Guardian's website, and saw that there had been this attack, and I think I instinctively knew that this was about cartoons. And so I clicked through and realized, yes, this is about cartoons. And my response was immediate, which was to, I suppose, a kind of defiant response to say that the caption of the cartoon was powerful, more powerful, and it had the terrorist as powerful, but the hand of a cartoonist drawing is more powerful. And so, as you said, as you described it, that idea that the pen is mightier than the sword. And so my initial response was to see it as an attack on free speech, as an attack on the ideals of the Enlightenment. But over the next couple of maybe 2 weeks, as I reflected on it, you know, I realized too that it's important for us to ask the question why these young French guys did what they did, and to ask critical questions about French society and our own society too, of course, about why some people feel so marginalized that they go do these things. So I still feel good about how that cartoon came out, but I think there's many nuances to that issue.
Sure.
that are not captured in that cartoon.
Well, I think it also appeared on the website of the U.S. State Department.
It did. I mean, it was truly flabbergasting to be in that situation where I was fielding phone calls pretty much all day from people asking permission to use it or to ask for comment on it. It appeared in print in the Wall Street Journal. It appeared on news websites all over the world. And yeah, it was the front page of the State Department's website for 2 or 3 days. So it was a kind of surreal experience.
Now, you weren't the only political cartoonist to react to that attack. Everybody weighed in on that.
I think there's a list of, I mean, there's probably hundreds of cartoons, but there's certainly scores of cartoons that were really powerful. I mean, obviously it was hitting cartoonists in a very personal way because, you know, they were the ones who'd been killed. And a lot of really magnificent cartoons came out of that.
Of course, this is a very serious topic. Ironically, at first, you explored the idea of being a gag cartoonist. And I think you had an interview at the New Yorker.
Well, it was...
Which is a magazine that focuses
right,
on these great cartoons.
Right. Well, I'd entered a competition in 2006, and part of the prize was a meeting with Bob Mankoff, the legendary cartoon editor of the New Yorker. And so I took a bunch of my cartoons with me, over lunch I handed my portfolio over to him with great excitement, and he basically just kind of savagely dissed them all, and I left with my tail between my legs. But I, in a funny way, it also encouraged me. You know, it motivated me to keep going. And once the pain of what he'd said wore off, you know, I look at these cartoons now and I think, yeah, they really are terrible. But he also gave me some pretty good advice about how jokes work and, you know, what really makes a cartoon stand out. And so I think gag cartooning comes easily to some people. It doesn't come easily to me. I mean, I think I'm quite a funny person, but just sitting down and writing gags is not easy for me. And I found myself able to produce political cartoons much, much more easily. So I think you just go with what your talent is.
Well, you know, like I think these gags, they have to have a line, usually a line there. I mean, some cartoons can, you just look at the picture and
yeah,
you get it.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need a line. It's almost like writing a headline.
Yeah.
You have to condense this thought into like 5 or 6 words. And that's really tough to do.
It is. And oftentimes there's a sort of incongruity in the situation. You know, it's a dog talking to a human being, or it's a snowman talking to a human, you know, whatever. It's something that shouldn't really be happening is happening, and that's where the heart of the joke is. But yeah, getting it down just a few words. People have done these meta analyses of New Yorker cartoons, sure. And you know, the optimum number of words is 9 or something like that. It's kind of funny, but yeah, it's tough to do. I mean, if you've ever tried to do the caption contest and at the back of the New Yorker, you know,
it's incredible.
It's tough. Yeah, it's a lot of smart people out there.
Well, speaking of smart people, Carl K. Connect. Now, for people who don't know who he is or was, this guy prompted you to write a book about him. So he had to be a very special character.
Yeah, well, I mean, primarily I wanted to write about him because he's a cartoonist, and he was the Courier's cartoonist from 1906 to 1960. But as soon as you start looking at his life, you realize that here's someone who in my humble opinion, is one of the 4 or 5 most important people in Evansville's history. Someone who really profoundly shaped the city. You know, he was first and foremost a cartoonist, but he also wrote many, many columns, hundreds and hundreds of columns for the paper. He wrote numerous other things for other magazines. He was basically the person responsible for bringing Mesker Park Zoo to Evansville. He was a huge booster for bringing the University of Evansville from Moores Hill to Evansville in 1917. He is someone he was the first person to fly an airplane over Evansville. He was the first person to take aerial photographs of the city from 1906 roughly till I think the 30s. He was the Courier's photographer as
sure.
well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, most of the iconic photos that you've ever seen of Evansville in that early period, including many but not all of the Evansville flood photos from 1937, Carl K. Connect took these photos too. So he's someone who really had a finger in almost every aspect of Evansville life for a very long period of time, making these political comments every single day on the front page of the paper. And although I looked hard, I couldn't find a record of a single person who disliked him. So you tell me how you do that. It's pretty amazing.
I had a chance to meet him.
Did you really?
I met him.
Wow.
I was working for the Sunday Courier and Press. I was still going to the University of Evansville, and I was working part-time there. And one of my assignments, the feature, was to go talk to him. And I forget what the hook was for the story. He probably was celebrating his so many years of writing, doing cartoons. He lived in a condominium out on the east side. He had recently moved there, and his wife living there. Went up to took the elevator up to the penthouse of this condominium tower, and there he was. He had a visor on. He was perfectly dressed. He had a bow tie.
Yeah,
a very kind of diminutive kind of guy. But very polite, and his wife had made tea.
Oh, how wonderful.
For my visit. Yeah. And it was just a wonderful chat with him, and he had a big drawing board
there in
his living room. Just a fascinating guy and just as sweet as can be.
Yeah.
But, he was quite a character. And, he was an activist, too, because he was promoting things all the time. And he crammed a lot into those cartoons.
He did. I mean, I think he had so many different interests, health and safety, worker safety, traffic regulations, better infrastructure, so bridges and expanding the airport and getting a better highway to Evansville, and all of these things, again, many of which are very modern issues. He was booster for all of these things, and tirelessly boosting local charities, the United Way and the Red Cross and so on. And one of the things I found in my research that I thought was great was that he drew a cartoon during World War II that was calling for people to donate time to the Red Cross to package bandages.
Mm-hmm.
And in the archives at U of E, I found a letter that he had received from the local president of the Red Cross, and she was telling him that the day after that cartoon, their phones had been ringing off the wall mm-hmm. with people volunteering. So as a cartoonist, you don't always know if your work has had an impact, but there was a little crystal piece of evidence that his cartoon had an impact.
Well, he also, I think, called on the school children of Evansville when they to the zoo to get Bunny the elephant, and people sent in all kinds of money. The kids collected.
Right, the first elephant, Kay.
Yeah, Kay. I'm sorry, Kay.
Right. He encouraged people to donate, and the paper would carry a list of people who donated every day. Mm-hmm. And he drew numerous cartoons about it. And he, of course, as Erin Gibson told the great story mm-hmm. in her wonderful film Two Elephants, he himself traveled to meet Kay and traveled with her coming back. And there's a wonderful cartoon he drew the day that Kay arrived in Evansville, where he it's an aerial shot of Evansville, but it makes Evansville look like it's shaped like an elephant. It's a pretty famous cartoon and really great. And as you said, the tiny little details from that day forward. So that was the late 20s. He added a little elephant to his signature, and that elephant was called Kay. Mm-hmm. And she provides a little bit of commentary either on the cartoon that he's drawn or on something else completely. And I'm often talking to audiences about World War II, of course. And in one of his most famous World War II cartoons at the beginning of the war, where he's depicting everybody rolling their sleeves up to get involved, if you look down in the corner, Kay is rolling her sleeves up too. So she was a very activist little elephant.
Well, speaking of activism, are you kind of like the guy in the crowd pointing out the truth about the Emperor's new clothes? Is that your role?
I think that is the role of cartoonists. Yeah, I don't want to take myself too seriously. I think there's lots of cartoonists out there who are doing so much more prominently than me, of course. But I think your job is to afflict the comfortable and call it as you see it, and criticize powerful people if necessary, and sometimes that's a pretty scary position to be in. If you're on a national level, you're obviously getting a lot of attention, but even at a local level, you have to ask yourself sometimes, do I want to produce this cartoon about person X or institution X, when that might have ramifications for my family and me. So it's a pretty sobering mm-hmm. position sometimes.
We are talking to Dr. James McLeod, University of Evansville history professor and political cartoonist for the Evansville Courier. Now, James, a lot of your cartoons are celebratory. You're talking about the progress of this community, new buildings. And you even drew one about my retirement at WFIE, showing a jersey, being retired after 41 years. Thank you again for
You're
that.
You're welcome.
Now, others do strike a nerve. And what's some of the feedback you've received from your cartoons? Any really negative feedback?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like For a long time, I was drawing cartoons, and I felt like nobody knew who I was. And then eventually, you're just been there long enough that pretty much now when I meet somebody new, I usually get one of two reactions. It's either, oh, you're the cartoonist, or it's, oh, you're the cartoonist. I think if you're going to take a political stance on anything, and as everybody knows, my politics are basically liberal, progressive view of the world. You're going to upset people, and I have some people who just say you're an idiot, you're a fool, your drawings are terrible, and you suck, basically, mm-hmm. which is fine. But I also have critics who are hyper intelligent people with whom I have great conversations. And I've got good friends who are conservatives who will argue back and forth with me about a stance on immigration or the budget or gun control or whatever. And I think that's great. I think it's important to have dialogue. It's important that people who disagree with each other talk to each other. And I'm not trying to be neutral. I'm not trying to see both sides of it. I mean, I think as a historian, you are always preaching nuance, and I'm constantly talking to students about gray areas and how on most issues there's not a right answer and a wrong answer. It's somewhere in between. I'm very aware of the importance of nuance and of seeing both sides. But as a cartoonist, you know, I think your job is to have a position on a given topic and then express it as clearly as you can.
Well, I know as being a journalist, I mean, you quickly learn there are two sides to every story, sometimes three, mm-hmm. sometimes four, mm-hmm. and there's sometimes you just put it out there, and yeah. people have to come up with their own ideas of what's right and wrong. So I know it's an opinion page too.
Right.
I mean, that's where people go to see different opinions.
Exactly.
That's your job.
Exactly. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think if and I think the paper does a pretty good job of publishing cartoons that reflect other views. The paper this morning had a cartoon that was, you know, critiquing socialism and critiquing the Democratic
sure.
Party.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fine.
Yeah. I think every morning should be a Christmas morning for political cartoonists with the Trump administration, because there's always something brewing there, and it changes hourly, it seems like.
It really does. I mean, if you don't have Twitter as a cartoonist, you know, I don't know what you do. But yeah, I have two responses to that. One is there's a kind of jokey response to it, which is that all you need to do is draw a picture of what's just happened, and you've got a gag right there. The serious side of it is that there's a ton of really serious issues being discussed and issues that we need to be discussing and thinking about. And I think a editorial cartoonist is part of that conversation. So I'm glad to be that.
Well, still to come, we're going to talk about the importance of knowing about our past, the good and the bad, because if history doesn't exactly repeat itself, there are definitely some rhymes and echoes that can't be ignored. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back. This is 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Dr. James McLeod, history professor at the University of Evansville, author and political cartoonist for the Evansville Courier. And you tell the story of Evansville during World War II in a book and a documentary film. Why do we need to know about this, James?
Well, I think that, again, I would take two approaches to that answer. One is, in general terms, I think it's really important that we know where we came from, that we know what people have done in the past and hopefully learn lessons from that, see things that we should be doing again and see things that we shouldn't be doing again. From an Evansville point of view, I think there's an enormous source of pride there. Here's something that we did that was truly amazing. And it was people just like us, and they were doing it right here. Okay, we can look out the window and see where the shipyard was. And so there's lots and lots of people here that sadly didn't know that we did all that stuff. So I feel really, it's a source of great pride isn't quite the word, but I feel really honored that I was able to tell this story, both in the book and in the documentary through the TV station here with Joe Atkinson, so that these voices will be preserved. And that, when we were making the documentary, that was one of the things that was really sobering and a powerful reminder to us of the reality of it. We interviewed about 40 people, the oldest of whom was 99 years old. And by the time we had edited and got that documentary ready for broadcast on WNIN, several of the folks that we had interviewed had already passed away. Mm-hmm. So I think both Joe and I really wish that we had done this 20 years ago,
sure,
when these folks were in their 70s instead of their 90s. But, I'm glad we did it. And the story was told as to the best of our ability.
And it's still being told, I think, through the Evansville Wartime Museum that just celebrated its one-year anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the LST 325, it looks like it's going to have a new home next to the casino, a lot more visible there.
Yeah.
More people will go on board and see the history of that ship.
Oh, I think that is absolutely great. I just finished drawing a cartoon which showed the LST, with the captain saying, set a course for downtown, full speed ahead. So, you know, yeah, the city council voted 8-1 last night. And I think it's really wonderful that the city is putting its money where its mouth is as far as our World War II past. To have the LST downtown with a purpose-built museum right there, or a visitor center anyway, so close to where the shipyard was, I think really ties the whole thing together really nicely. And all the folks at the Evansville Wartime Museum, I think these are volunteers who've worked really hard to preserve our past. And if you haven't had a chance to visit it, it's a really great museum, and I recommend it thoroughly. And I should also say, I'm not saying this just because I'm on the board of the Evansville Museum, but you know, there's been a wonderful exhibit at the Evansville Museum on Evansville and World War II for years. Tom Lomberg, the curator of history there, who does a wonderful job. You know, if you want to know about Evansville and World War II, you know, visit the Evansville Museum, visit the Wartime Museum, and visit the LST, and you'll be pretty well informed.
Well, it's not just the people who fought the war; it's the people on the home front who made the weapons that won the war. It's just so many people involved in this, and these are people's grandparents and great grandparents, and they should be very proud of what they did.
They really should, and you know, I think that as a British person, you know, you sort of bristle a little bit about Americans taking the credit for winning World War II. I think the Allies could only win World War II with the contributions of all three, the USSR and Britain and the USA. But if you had to say what was the single most important thing that won World War II for the Allies, it's American production. You know, the British were supplied by the United States. The Russians were certainly supplied by the United States. And, you know, and that American stuff was carried in British ships, crewed by people like my dad, to these North Russian ports. And hundreds and thousands of these men died on these trips, you know, so everybody played a part. But ultimately, it came down to the fact that Allied servicemen had more stuff available. And it wasn't necessarily that our stuff was better, we just had more of it. Mm-hmm. And a place like Evansville producing, you know, I often talk about how 45 caliber ammunition, we produced 96% of all the 45 caliber ammunition in World War II came out of Maxwell Avenue in Evansville. Mm-hmm. Pretty
and
also, amazing.
And 167 LSTs built in Evansville. And of course, they were instrumental in the invasion of Europe and winning the war.
If you think about what Americans were doing in World War II, we were putting men on contested beaches. And it's impossible to imagine that we could have won the war in the Pacific and that we could have successfully landed in North Africa and Italy and Normandy without something like the LST. So people of Evansville should hold their heads very high about what we did 75 years ago.
Now, you're a history professor, and there's a lot of stress now on the STEM studies, but the humanities, I think you're probably a defender of the humanities.
Oh, yeah, I certainly am. And the humanities are facing a time of crisis right now. If you look at enrollment in humanities courses or people who are majoring in the humanities at American universities, it has fallen catastrophically since 2006.
Now, that's history, literature.
History, literature,
philosophy.
Writing, philosophy, religion, all of that stuff, yeah. And actually, it includes even things like political science and international studies that are social sciences but have a large humanities element. So, you know, I think it's really important that we have people who study STEM, of course, and I would really encourage that. But you have to have both. You know, I think we have to have people that can think critically, even about things that are very dear to them. You know, I'm a big supporter of you know, being a booster for your own community and your own country and your own workplace and all of that. But part of that is being critical. Thinking, how could we do things better? And so if you have no awareness of American history, for example, how do you make sense of you know, the right-wing protesters marching in Washington, D.C. this weekend? How do you make sense of Black Lives Matter? The president this morning referred to one of his former staff, a black woman, as a dog. How do you make sense of that if you have no knowledge of American history? So, you know, I think we all have a civic duty to learn about our past, understand why things happened in the past, and I think it tells us why we are here. And as you alluded in one of your comments a few minutes ago, David, it's about the future too, you know, because I think one of the things Martin Luther King said, and Obama often quoted this, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And it's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. It's a great line. But I don't believe it. I mean, I don't think the arc of the moral universe bends anywhere unless we bend it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, the lesson of the civil rights struggle, for example, isn't that in the end, awesome America gave civil rights to black people. You know, it's that black people and white people were willing to die to make this thing happen. You know, women were willing to die to get women's rights. And, you know, gay people have died to get gay people rights, and so on and so on. So, you know, I wish that weren't the case, and I certainly don't hope that for anybody. But, you know, we might have to fight hard for the things that we hold dear. And to me, that's one of the most important lessons of our past.
So what are your students interested in knowing about? What are on the minds of the students today in your classrooms?
Pretty much video games, I think. No, I'm kidding. They're, it's really, you know, I think I have a wonderful job. You know, to get to spend your life with a bunch of 18 to 22-year-olds is really a great privilege. And I feel really optimistic. I tell a story real quick that I had a student in class a couple of semesters ago who some of your listeners may know, a gentleman called Jay Wirtz. And, you know, Jay is in his 80s and, you know, a representative of a great old Evansville family. And so as I think he was 85 when he was in my class. And he took my World War I and my World War II classes. So he's in there with a bunch of 20-year-olds. And at the end of the semester, he said, "I've never been more optimistic for the future of America than I am after having been in this class with these kids."
That's so great.
That made me feel really good.
Definitely.
You know, these are bright kids who are serious, who are thinking about important issues. And, you know, we denigrate them. It's very easy. It's always been easy, I think, for us old mm-hmm. folks to mock the young and think they're unserious and unimportant and unconcerned. And they're really not, you know. And if you think back to the American Revolution, many of these, you know, the founding fathers, many of them were really young. The people who made the progressive era happen, many of them were really young. The people who marched at Selma and the people who got beaten in Montgomery and all of that were oftentimes really young people. So, you know, sometimes there comes a point in our lives where we have to say, you know, maybe we haven't done enough, and you hand it over to the young folks. And, you know, all of my experience with the kids at UE, and, you know, I occasionally teach classes at USI as well, they're great. And you know, I think the future is strong, but it will be what we make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to end with some Scottish phrases, and maybe you can help me with this, James. I'm getting the messages.
That's going shopping, going to the
grocery
store.
Grocery store, yes. Yeah. Your bum's out the window.
It's time for you to leave.
You're talking trash, not making sense. Is that, or how would you?
Yeah.
It's time to, oh, get out.
Yeah,
okay, get out. Okay, Okay. She's up to high dough.
she is getting a little bit testy,
yes.
High strung, something
yes,
like that. That was one of my mom's favorites.
Yeah,
yeah,
she's got herself all riled up.
Yeah.
She's up to high dough. You're a wee scunner.
You're a person of low... low repute, maybe.
A little whiner, a nuisance, a pain, and then, yeah.
Yeah.
You're a long time died?
You're a long time deed.
You're gonna be
dead for a long time, so you should be active while you're alive, something
there you
like
go.
That.
That's yeah. great. Okay, and here's what here I'll butcher this one, I know it. Lang may your yum reek.
Lang may your lums reek. Is really means may there always be smoke coming out of your chimney, which I guess just means, you know, I'm wishing you health and happiness in a domestic environment.
Or Mr. Spock might say, live long and prosper.
Exactly, exactly.
And that phrase again is?
Lang may your lum reek.
Okay.
So a lum is a chimney.
Okay.
And reek is smell.
There you go.
So,
wow.
Yeah. The thing I always used to joke about with folks when I got here was that, you know, there's so much English stuff that is slightly different in America. And, you know, the word pants, which in here just means your trousers, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But pants means underwear in Britain. So, you know, there's all of these comical moments when people say things like, can't wear these pants tonight and stuff, which is kind of rude in Britain, but here people say it all the time. So,
Well, we're going to say this again. Lang may your lum reek.
There you go.
So long may your chimney smoke, live long and prosper. That's a proper Scottish farewell to our listeners and to our guest, Dr. James McLeod, who has shared his passion for history and for being an active and involved citizen. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport.